EMS on the Mountain is an entertainment, educational, and commentary product recorded by Sean and Mike and produced by them. Nothing recorded by Sean, Mike, or any of the guests of the show is endorsed nor authorized by their respective employers or agencies unless explicitly outlined. All commentary and statements made are their own. Always follow your respective medical protocols. Nothing said on this platform should be considered medical direction. Now, on with the show.
Welcome to the EMS on the Mountain podcast, a show for those interested in austere and wilderness medicine. This podcast provides insight into the unique aspects and challenges of bringing modern EMS into wilderness and austere environments. Yeah, Jesus, every time with you. And on that note, everyone, welcome back. Finally, another episode of EMS on the Mountain. Sorry for all the delays, but we've had shit and stuff going on. And with that, Michael, what are we discussing on this glorious evening?
Well, long story short, it's time we branch out a little bit and talk about all the other things that make wilderness medicine wilderness medicine. We've touched on a number of things like land navigation and communications and stuff like that. There's one topic that I've been putting off, but seems applicable because Sean and I were just out teaching. The ability to move vertically, aka rope things. This is probably going to end up being multiple podcasts, multiple discussions with multiple people, but it goes hand in hand with doing wilderness medicine. And in some ways, it's the what I'll call the sexy part of doing cool guy wilderness medicine-y stuff, because everybody wants to take a picture of themselves hanging from a rope looking cool doing medical things if you're a medical guy. All of that's bullshit, by the way, but we'll get into that. So today, Sean and I are going to discuss vertical movement or raising and lowering patients and people and things using mechanical advantage and ropey things. This is going to be a spicy topic. Spicier than most topics. And
yeah,
I'm actually going to go out on a leg and say this is going to be spicier than most of the things we say on here. And that's saying something, because I usually don't have any problem saying some pretty spicy shit.
Yeah. And for our listeners who aren't in the technical rope rescue world, this is an area, whether you are a man, it doesn't matter if you're a fire-based technical rescue, confined space, rope dude, wilderness, industrial access, like guys doing repair work and stuff on the top of wind turbines, like rope access stuff is probably one of the most contentiously debated and argued things on the planet. And it's, I find it comical myself because goddamn, there's only so many ways to do rope work, but everybody's technique is the one and everybody else's is wrong. And people take absolute hardline stances on it, and it's pretty crazy.
I have sat around campfires, drinking beers with guys, and watched fistfights occur over things related to stupid, not mantras, but like religion related to what is considered safe and not safe and how something should be done. It's like getting eight paramedics on a call for Meemaw, who doesn't feel good. Everyone's got an opinion on what's supposed to happen. And everybody's probably wrong.
And I would agree with you on that at a certain level. But at a certain point, all those paramedics are going to be like, yeah, all right, so let's do those ABC things and go to the hospital. Whereas rope people would be like, if you do this, you will die. And it's like, but I haven't yet.
To be fair, in the paramedic scenario, it's going to be the new EMT that's going to step in and be like, guys, can we just take her to the hospital?
Yeah, this might be true too. Guys, I don't know if anybody else has noticed, but she's blue now. Can we go?
Can we go?
Yeah.
Hey, can somebody grab a backbone mask? That'd be great. All right. So let me start this off by saying there are more ways to skin the vertical environment cat than I can name. We're going to get into standards bodies here in a second, but here's the beginning advice that Mike will give you that you can choose not to listen to, and most of you probably won't. But I will actually say that this is foundationally probably the only good advice I will ever give on this podcast. If rope work is something you are engaged in or are interested in or want to go do or want to learn more about, I don't give a shit what school you go to, what YouTube videos you watch. Learn the concepts of mechanical advantage and force. Do not get sucked into the mantra or the religion related to this device versus that device, or 10 to 1 versus 15 to 1, or steel versus aluminum, or blah, 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 blah. You need to understand a little bit about metallurgy. You need to understand a little bit about vectors and forces and T factors and things. But if you get that stuff down, you can figure out a problem pretty expertly and stay safe. If you get sucked into...
The NFPA says that it's got to be a 10-to-1 full steel system at all times with triple redundancy in case something goes wrong.
You're going to end up just being one of those assholes that gets into fistfights over dogma that doesn't matter. I will tell you right now that, and again, I'm going to get into the standards bodies, but the triple redundant, got to have multiple ropes all the time sort of schools of thought are not any more or less safe than the arborists that are climbing 60 feet up into a tree with a single freaking rope. But it, Mike, is not about how many ropes you have.
What if one of those trees should evaporate?
I mean, they do that all the time. We protect against that all the time in the wilderness rescue world, don't we, Sean? Oh my God, guys, we got to have triple redundant anchors because, you know, what if the tree falls down? Okay.
No, it's not what if the tree falls down. It is.
Sorry, what if it evaporates?
The tree suddenly, like, literally is kidnapped by aliens?
Yeah, just disappears under the same mantra of, let's just get into it. So, yeah.
Standards bodies, go. First,
there are a ton of standards bodies. As with most things in the industrial world, there's standards bodies because somebody was like, we need a better set of standards. And that's as far as it ever went. Most of them are driven... Actually, the analogy of they're the Red Cross of rope work is not completely horrible. The big ones out there, especially in the rescue world, the NFPA, the National Fire Protection Association, has a whole suite of standards that are often referred to by many well-meaning but maybe not fully educated people in the space of, like, how to stay safe when doing rope stuff. Other big ones that come up in the wilderness rescue world in particular, NASAR actually does have a standard.
Wow, thank God.
Yeah, I know. The MRA is probably talked about as one of the bigger quintessential standards bodies for wilderness rescue. It stands for the Mountain Rescue Association. The National Cave Rescue, NCRC, National Cave Rescue Commission, is actually pretty widely adopted for some of their standards bodies things. And in fact, fun fact, a lot of fire departments now are sending people to NCRC classes because to get approved for a lot of fire jobs, you just have to go to a class that meets a standard that the NFPA recognizes, and NCRC is one of them. There's a lot of, like, firefighters that are going to cave rescue classes and then becoming, like, confined space rescue experts through that avenue. Technically, I wouldn't call this a standards body, but the National Park Service is looked at as leading standards expert in the space. Is that the best way to describe it?
Yeah, only because
I don't know how to describe it, but the Park Service is looked at as, like, having, you know,
I will, a good we'll head call on them subject shoulders. Matter experts.
Yeah, that's a good way of
putting it. They don't set a standard per se, but they have established guidelines that are based on industry best practice that they recommend parks and rescue teams follow. So I would put them in that subject matter expert kind of realm.
Yep. And then mostly in jest, and this is for Johnny B, our most loyal listener, the ITRA is, and they're one of the bigger international standards bodies that is trying to promote a uniform international standard and certification process. Here comes Sean. You ready? Here comes the joke. I am actually a card holding ITRA level 3 instructor for multiple different disciplines, including rope access, helicopter access, tactical rope rescue for cool guy stuff. Like, I have some of the certifications. So full disclosure, I am technically part of the ITRA.
And for those that don't know, that is the International Technical Rescue Association.
Yes. And there's others. These are the ones I had in my notes, but the Forest Service actually, they participate with the NPS in the DOI space. There's a number of private companies as well that are actually looked at as pseudo standards or pseudo experts in this space. ArmRope One.
Ropes That Rescue.
A lot of these are programs that you can attend. And there's a lot of them. They're programs you can attend, but they're looked at as a certifying, almost a pseudo certifying body, if you will. Because it's fuzzy. I'll put it that way. You can go down a deep, dark rabbit hole. I believe it's in Utah in the US. And then I believe it's also somewhere in France. Petzl actually has a training academy where you can go to the Petzl training academy. Learn it by
CMC's got one.
CMC has one. ASHI has one.
Yeah.
And then quite honestly, there's a whole number of people. I know a number of people in the industry that are like, oh, I learned stuff and now I'm an expert. So I'm going to teach. It's like paramedic school. Oh, you're a paramedic? Would you like to educate other paramedics? Please. Come, we'll hire you. Or maybe that's just been our experience, Sean.
No, I think that's a national thing.
Yeah, it is. It is. So there's a bunch of standards out there. So why am I bringing this up? I'm bringing this up partially because Sean and I were just teaching and it felt like a timely thing for us to talk about. I'm bringing this up partially because I'm starting to get more questions about how do I learn more about rope rescue things and stuffs. And I wanted to talk about the fact that there are so many different disciplines and there are similarities between them. But just off the top of my head, and this is not from notes, so I'm probably going to miss something. Don't get mad at me. Urban rescue, industrial access rescue, tower rescue, trench rescue, confined space rescue, traditional wilderness rescue, alpine environments, desert environments could
maybe be considered
differently. Yeah. Yeah. Those are the ones I can think of off the top of my head. Every one of those different disciplines, plus the others I have not mentioned, are going to have slightly variant standards as to what's considered safe and unsafe. For example, the National Fire Protection Agency or administration? I can never remember.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't care.
Association. So I definitely got it wrong. I believe depending on the particular standard, it's either a 10-1 or a 15-1 safety ratio. I am perfectly comfortable with a 5-1 ratio for a lot of wilderness things I do. When it's just me accessing a particular, I'm going to produce a 10-1 shock load on the side of a cliff while rappelling, I'm doing something very wrong. But I'm bringing this up because you are going to see different standards bodies talk about things in different ways. 10-1 is a industry standard, and I'm not going to go super, super deep into it. If we get a bunch of comments, and by a bunch for us, that means three, where people say, oh, I want to know more, I'll put something together. But as a general rule of thumb, you want to be able to shock load a system with 10 times the unit of measure. It's called a kilonewton, or 10 times the force of the static load in most wilderness environments. Some industrial stuff is up to 20. Heavy rigging is a little bit different. The ratios are a little bit different. But as a general rule of thumb in the wilderness, 10-1 is your safety factor. Now, this is where things get wonky, and this is one of the things I wanted to talk about in relation to wilderness rescue on whole. There are a lot of people, and here comes the spicy piece. There are a lot of people that want to implement industrial safety standards and industrial rules to wilderness rescue. God.
Yeah, and it's growing, and
it's becoming enraging to me.
Say for every agency that finds its way to single rope technique using new modern 9mm lines, there's somebody else that's going to 11.5 and 4 ropes and just absurd stuff. So,
yeah. What Sean mentioned there, when I got into this work almost 20 years ago now, 12mm rope was considered the standard. 11.5 was like the new hotness in rope technology. So if it was 11.5mm in diameter, that rope was rated for the weight it was rated for a 10-1 safety ratio for shock loading for the weight of a rescue load. You can now get down. There's actually some stuff out there that's 7.5 and 8 millimeters in diameter.
Yeah.
That will hold a 10-to-1 safety ratio.
Stuff.
And with advents in technology like Technora, you're good to go. I would never want to shock load Technora.
No, God, that would hurt.
It's going to hurt a lot. Technora has zero give. I guess I should mention for those that are unaware, there's really fundamentally two different types of rope. There's what's called dynamic rope, and that is commonly used in rock climbing and climbing type activities where it's a safety factor. It's very stretchy. It'll stretch a lot when loaded, which reduces the energy that is pushed into the system and into the anchors and the things that are holding the ropes in place versus what is commonly referred to as static line. Static line does not have as much stretch, but is better for uses like hauling systems and rescue systems, places where you're not going to fall. You're not going to fall 10, 12 feet attached to this rope. At least you shouldn't if it's set up properly. So you don't need that much stretch because you don't want to have to haul the stretch out of the rope in general. And then there's a subcategory that's starting to develop called super static. It's not a formal title, but that's where technologies like Technora come into play. It's basically zero give. So all of the energy is transferred into the thing on the end of the rope, typically you as a human, and it hurts, so you don't want to fall on it. That about sums it up, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Okay. Yeah, just know that as Mike and I are talking about ropes in general today, we're talking about static ropes. As you mentioned, the dynamic rope is almost exclusively found in the climbing community just because of it does stretch, it absorbs the load, and reduces that sudden jarring impact on the system in general. So when we're talking about this, we're talking about rescue stuff. So static, don't think we're like crossing between the two unless we very specifically mention when you might use a piece of dynamic rope for something.
Yeah. And there's a whole subset of static rope out there. This is where following your agency's requirements and doing your own research comes into play. There's what's called PET rope, which is an abbreviation for polyester. There's Technora, there's Twan, there's Kevlar, there's Vectrin, there's Spectra, there's Dyneema, liquid crystal, which I think is Vectrin, but I don't remember off the top of my head. All of these ropes have different weaves, and they have different principles to them about how much they stretch, how much they can hold, whether they have UV resistance or not. And then there's a whole other set of ropes that are specifically made for industry-specific work. For example, tree ropes are made specifically for the abusive environment of tree work for arborists.
Yeah.
There are specific ropes made for climbing. There's specific ropes made for certain tactical use cases. The plethora of options that are out there is more than probably worth talking about. And I wanted to get everyone podcast off. I could talk about it, but
yeah, see, that's a whole nother episode, man. You could talk about just rope construction.
And I will put this out here right now. If a bunch of people say, oh, we want to know all the intricacies of the hardware things, I'll do a video or something. I do a instructional thing every year for the course that I teach with Sean on different types of rope, diameters, friction hitches, carabiners, pulleys, all these things. If a whole bunch of people are like, let's do it, I'll make a video. But otherwise, go hit up CMC or Yates or Petzl or Sterling or the rope manufacturers, because it turns out they have pretty good material on their website. Petzl is, by the way, one of the best places to learn about stuff. Petzl's website's got a lot of good information on it. So anyway, there's a whole bunch of different ropes. Typically in the industry, you're going to hear about a 10-to-1 safety standard. And I want to get back to my, oh my gosh, the world is not ready for all of these specialty things. I'm going to use three different parallel industries to describe what I mean when I say everyone's getting a little ridiculous about following the rules as opposed to understanding the standard, and why understanding how T-factors work and how force works is way more important than doing quote-unquote what the book says. First off, the guy that wrote the book probably understands more about T-factors than I do or you do. Their recommendation should be taken with a strong bent toward this dude researched this. I'm not talking about the guys that wrote the books. I'm pretty good friends with a guy that writes a lot of books on the subject.
Yeah. Literally.
Like he writes novels. Like
massive books. This guy knows more about, like, he has forgotten more about rope work than I will ever know. And I've been doing it a long time. Shout out to Eddie. Your book is pretty awesome. I'm not talking about the guys that write the books. The guys that actually take the time to write the books, this is a passion for them. This is a thing they understand intimately. They're probably employed in the industry in some way, manner, shape, or form. They've been around it a long time. I'm talking about the guys that, and I'm not taking a shot at anybody directly, but I'm talking about the guys that go to a class that is taught by a guy that went to a set of classes. And whatever that guy says, because I took his class, that's got to be the truth. It's, there's something about the rope work industry that is so dogmatic and hearsay driven. It's enraging. And here's the three examples I'm going to use. Wilderness rescue is really not a skill set in and of itself. It's a combination of two fundamental things. And I might be the first person to ever say this ever, but it's the truth. Let's see if Sean agrees. Wilderness rescue in and of itself really takes a certain subset of, I'll call it industrial principles, or the principles of moving yourself and other people or things on rope, and merges them with a hybrid of both a caving and a rock climbing skill set.
Yeah. Yes. I think the problem is, so I'd say probably the mountain stuff came first, just based on historical stuff, right? People were climbing mountains before we were climbing doing rope access, like ropes, rescue on high buildings, right?
Yep.
I think the thing now is that you have that, like you mentioned, like the guys writing the books kind of thing involved in the industry, there's a lot of bleed over, right? So caving guys took mountain guys stuff, modified it a little bit and made it caving specific. And then some mountain guys went to a caving course and went, ooh, that actually is pretty slick. We should implement something like that on outside of caves. And so that happens. And then the industrial guys get in there. And this is where the guys invent like the cool gadgets, I think. It really comes from the industrial side of things.
I agree.
And next thing you know, we're trying to take industrial things and forcing them to fit into cave and alpine rescue stuff. And so these three, we'll call those the three big spheres of this rescue world. There's bleed over and innovation that occurs in each one, and each one looks at the other and says, ooh, that's a good idea. Let's bring that over. And sometimes they just straight one for one it, which I'll put it out there. The Petzl ASAP, like for those of you that are listening and know what that is, God damn, I don't ever want to see another one of those in the wilderness setting again, but they're out there. That was something developed for the industrial world, guys working alone at height where there is nothing else but them and their ropes. Yeah. And somehow the wilderness people are like, oh, that's grand. We can have this extra thing on a whole nother rope and blah, blah. It's just, anyway. But, and so I think you're right that there's a lot of believer. I think there's a lot more relationship between the cave and the wilderness guys for sure. Just because they're both working in semi-similar austere environments like that, right? Where weight is a thing, size is a thing. You want the most bang for your buck, because like in the caving environment, when we're talking rope access inside caves, like it needs to be small, it needs to be light, it needs to be durable, right? Nobody's lugging 50 steel carabiners with them crawling through caves. That's just not happening. So I would agree with you there. And then, you start getting bad habits of one because somebody attended a course that has a more X focus and thought, oh yeah. And they'll, without thinking about it, just automatically want to bring that into the other environment. And that's when I think we have the issues.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit. I think you make a good point. Here's where I was going and why I said that caving is really a key component. Most of the, I'll call it innovation, or most of the technology that's out there, the equipment and the techniques to go up rope are really dialed in and perfected by cavers. That's probably an overgeneralization. The industry is, industrial height work is a thing. And I will actually refute my statement, because arborists are some folks that have to climb long distances on rope and want to.
I was going
to
tell you, vertical movement. Yeah, I was going to throw a nod to those guys because they've got some really pretty cool stuff.
They do. But when it comes to efficiency and not losing a millimeter when you're climbing up a rope, this is really where caving systems come into play. And
yeah.
I believe that a lot of the industrial vertical equipment is really predicated or foundationally based on stuff that was developed for caving in the late 70s and early 80s. Having a cammed ascension device attached low on your harness and as close to the body as possible so that you don't lose any progress when moving up the rope. That's a caving thing, right? That comes from caving.
Yeah. Harness.
Big wall is slightly different than cave. You can end up more free hanging on the rope. Climbing free hanging rope again is very similar in a caving world, in arborist world, and in industrial access world, but it's not really used a lot in the cliffy world, right? That's where you're going to be doing Yosemite big wall style wall climbs. So there is a lot of overlap. Why am I bringing this up? I feel like I'm rambling now and everybody's like, why is this guy talking about all the stuff? Let me tie this all together and then I'll keep going about standards bodies and where you should focus if you want to learn these things. The industrial world, right? The fire departments, the NFPA, those things, they're really good at triple redundant heavy shit that comes in a truck.
Yeah.
And it is leaking more and more into the wilderness setting. I cannot tell you the number of pictures. I'm not going to call anyone out. But the number of pictures I see of wilderness rescue teams that I've seen in the last 5 years wearing full body harnesses over all their other crap.
I mentioned that one of our last episodes, man. Dude, do you guys not have to carry your shit? Yeah. Holy crap. Let's bring my 15-pound Petzl fucking industrial harness into the woods. Holy balls, man. Stop that.
Yeah, weight matters. I'm not saying this is right or wrong. I'm just going to make a general statement that I've been doing wilderness rescue for a long time in an old school climbing harness with a couple of carabiners and a descension device. I did not need a full body harness with big steel attachment points mounted, sewn into the damn thing to be able to rappel down to my patient, do a pick off and get them safely to the ground. Now, is some of that stuff better? Maybe.
For those environments, absolutely.
Right. I'm not going to go any further into the statement, but I will tell you right now that when I do some teaching with my buddy Eddie that I mentioned, we actually specialize in teaching people that want to be quiet and not be known that they're there. And we abhor chest harnesses for that reason, because you lose a bunch of mobility in that. I know of teams that have gone away from chest harnesses because while it is true that if you take a fall and you shock load your system, you could potentially injure your back if you are not wearing a chest harness. Don't fall. Sometimes mitigating the risk is mitigating the risk. It's not protecting against what could potentially happen in an unfortunate circumstance.
The only thing I'm going to add with that, and this is something I see, and I know you see it too. Mm-hmm. When people wear harnesses or chest harnesses, it's usually the industrial ones, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we're worried about the fall and the injury of the lower back, people are still connecting at the lowest point, which still puts the load in the same spot as if you were just wearing a traditional sit harness. If you're not connecting it higher, you're not spreading that load, the shock over the body as a whole.
Nope.
And so it's people got to understand the gear they're wearing and why some of these attachment points are where they're at. And it's the same thing. If you just put on your normal sit climbing harness and you throw on whatever manufacturer's chest harness, mm-hmm. and you throw some whatever connection between the two points, the chest harness to your sit harness, and then you still connect to that low sit harness point, the chest harness really only helped you not necessarily fall out if you went inverted in some crazy scenario. But that's it, right? It's not spreading that load anywhere else. It's still centralized on that low point, which means your lower back is where you're going to, if you flex that way, is where you're going to flex and bend the wrong direction.
Yep.
So you have the gear, but you got to be wearing the gear and knowing what you're wearing and why you're mounting certain things in certain places and when you might want to change that up. But anyway.
Yeah, this is actually a really good example of the middle ground that I find enraging. I'll summarize it this way. An industrial fall mitigation harness is designed to be attached between the shoulder blades and catch you when you fall with things like Petzl makes a thing called a screamer or other load reduction energy dissipation tooling. You can't just attach yourself to the front of that harness and then call it a rescue harness. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
It's just not true. But this is the point I was going for, and we're already halfway into this podcast or half an hour into this podcast, and I haven't even gotten to my first point yet. It's time I do that. Going and buying Bob's cool guy rescue tool doesn't make you a wilderness rescue expert. And there's a lot of people that'll run circles around you by just understanding the environment and the equipment that they have available to them to execute the need. What I mean by that is, do not go buy that fancy harness because some guy says, this is the thing you got to have. Now, look, there's 100 billion teams out there and they all have different rules. Sean and I know a number of guys from out west that probably have certain standards that have to be met, right? Maybe they require full body harnesses. Maybe they require have to have a chest harness. That's fine. It's also perfectly okay to ask the question of why is this required and have people explain it to you. And you, and here's the other side of my point, you as the student, you have not only a duty, but an obligation to go understand the science and the physics of rescue and find someone that's going to teach you the physics of what you are mitigating, not the go buy this clickety widget, to quote my buddy Eddie. Go buy a clickety widget that does a thing and it solves the problem for you. Stuff doesn't make you a rope rescue expert. Knowledge does. The expensive tools made by Yates and CMC and Petzl. And look, I like the tools. I generally like the tools.
Some of them are cool.
They do neat things, but I understand the mechanics of what's happening. And with a couple of prusiks and a brake rack, I could probably achieve the same end result with half the weight. So if you are interested in getting into rescue, and look, it's cool. I like it. I enjoy it. Seek out schools that are going to help you understand the principles. If you don't spend at least an entire day at the beginning of class understanding manufacturing processes, what a kilonewton is, how to calculate it, what it is, what a 10 to 1 or a 15 to 1 safety factor is, how to mitigate risk, how duplicative, like adding more anchors doesn't make something safer. Stuff doesn't make it better. Those are the schools you want to go to. The schools that are going to tell you, oh, well, what you do is use this particular device for this purpose. That's not the place you want to go get your initial education. I'll pause there for a second. I'm sure Sean's got thoughts on that, but.
No, I would agree 100%, right? And like first things first, like my wife will tell you, sometimes more is just anchors doesn't make it more gooder, right? More carabiners on your harness doesn't make you a better rescuer. And I would say if you are not, I've been doing this a while. I've been to several different courses myself as a student, teaching things for various people as well. But if you go to your very first course and you think, I guess we're going to put it this way. So there's different students come with different backgrounds. Climbers like to think they're already really very well versed in a lot of this and then find that they're not. Because there's a difference between climbing and basic rappelling and basic climber type rope work than rescue stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I would offer is if you're coming from the fire side, like you're an engine dude and you're on your department's technical rescue team and you've got a good background. Yeah, I know how to set up a 3-to-1, 5-to-1, whatever system. I'm familiar with all these different devices and things that are out there. That's cool. Don't necessarily go looking for, because some of these companies run beginner, intermediate, advanced level type courses. Don't immediately run out and look for the advanced course. Don't be afraid to look at and take that initial basic entry level course where you're going to see some of the differences between what you're doing on, like in this example, the fireside, vice what guys in the backcountry and the wilderness are doing. You're going to see a lot of similarities. And you might see some things that make you scratch your head. Like, wait, you're only going to use the one rope here? It's like, yeah, duh. And then once you get that foundation, like Mike said, the principles, and this is my argument about wilderness medicine education, right? don't teach me how to use sticks, right? Teach me how to splint. If I know the principles of splinting, then I can improvise the device necessary to make that happen if I don't have it. Same thing with all this rescue stuff. If I know the principles, right? If I know what my rope is, what it's rated for, what do I know what I need to do with this rope? Am I going to raise something, lower something? Is somebody just need to go down it to get access to something? I have to know, you know, what I'm doing. And then if I understand the principles of all that, I know that given this equipment, this is what I can do, whether it's safe or it's not going to be safe and I need something else. So don't be scared. Get in, learn the basic foundational things, because if you know the foundational core material, adding onto it is so much easier. And that's all I got to say about that.
I'll add to that. The foundations are really important. So here's Mike's progression. And this is probably not going to be found in many popular schools, but this is what I believe. First, step one, you have to understand a little bit about mechanical advantage and T-factors. Before you ever touch a rope, you've got to understand just like you got to scratch the surface on the principles of mechanical advantage. What do I mean by that? You have to understand two principles, and I'm not going to go super deep into them, but you have to understand building a mechanical advantage system, a 2-to-1, 3-to-1, 5-to-1, 7-to-1, 9-to-1, 4-to-1, 8-to-1, whatever, right? You have to understand the principle behind that and how to properly calculate the load being placed on the different componentry in that system. And you have to understand how bending rope and friction coefficients results in managing the lowering of weight on a system. Was that clear as mud, Sean? Did that make sense?
It makes perfect sense to me, but like you, I've been at this a little while.
That's fair. So to summarize my summary, you've got to understand how to exert force on a rope that is configured in a manner to allow you to multiply the force you are introducing. And you have to understand how lowering devices manage weight that is being pulled on by gravity to go downward on a rope. You have to understand those two principles. You don't have to be a wizard at calculating T factors and force and all of those things. But if you're picking a school or you're going through an education process that doesn't start with those fundamentals, your instructors don't understand the meat of what they're teaching you. Because if you don't understand force, you can't understand a kilonewton. And if you can't understand a kilonewton, you can't understand the equipment. A kilonewton is the unit of measure that's used to determine how strong any given equipment used in the space is. So if you aren't given that basic foundation of what a kilonewton is and how it is calculated, then it's really hard to understand the equipment and how putting the different Lego blocks together to build a system result in certain forces on various components in the system. So you got to start with those basic principles. You can find all this stuff on YouTube as well. Go for it. It's a great resource. Step two, once you understand just, again, the cursory basics of force and how to calculate force, then we need to get into implementing said force. And I believe the first step is you got to be able to go up and down a rope. You got to be able to hang a rope. I should add building anchors and things like that, because it's really hard to go up a rope if you can't anchor it. But you got to understand the basics of moving yourself up and down a rope. Once you've nailed those two things, then you can start moving into rescue systems, because now all you're doing is taking the principles from step one and step two that I just mentioned, and you're applying them to a tertiary thing, a patient, a rescuee, a person stuck on a cliff, whatever the case may be. But if you jump to those things, or in a lot of schools, they jump right to building systems. They jump right to building systems before they understand the principles of the mechanical advantage system. Folks I've known, in my personal opinion, end up behind the curve for a long time, and they end up struggling when they get into more complex concepts like Tyrolean traverses, because they start with the principles of force and multiplication of forcing factors when you get beyond like a 90-degree angle and things. So if you're listening to this and you're like, dude, I want to be a rope rescue expert. I want to go in the woods and save lives and kick ass. First thing you have to understand is the foundational principles of building a system. And then from there, you got to be able to go up and down a rope by yourself first. Once you can go up and down a rope and you understand the principles of going up and down a rope, then you can start adding additional schooling and education in building systems. There. How's that, Sean? Did I jack that up pretty bad?
No, I like where you're at. And just for clarification, when we say go up a rope, we mean literally up the rope, not climbing, like putting on your little shoes and your little banana hammock shorts and climbing, but like ascending a free hanging or against a rope.
Now, so I will tell you, Wilderness Rescue incorporates both climbing capability and rope climbing capability, right?
100%.
You are going to need a certain amount of ability to climb a rock face if you're going to be a wilderness rescue expert. But that's not what we're talking about here. I'm talking about a free hanging rope and the ability to go up and down the rope by itself. Hang a rope in a tree and climb up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down. And then I'm about to say is complete sarcasm. And then eventually, once you get to step 32, you're going to be intubating someone live on a cliff face, hanging from a rope in a stone.
You are, because that's how good you're going to be. And that's you're going to bag them successfully.
Actually, we haven't actually talked about that rescue, but now that I'm thinking about it, okay, let me explain my snark. I often see pictures on social media where people are practicing like intubating in a Stokes on a cliff face. And I often think to myself, dude, if they needed to get intubated, it would have been a hell of a lot easier to do that before you started getting hauled up the cliff face.
Nah, details.
But I will say that we do have one story we need to talk about at some point on this thing where we did discuss intubating someone on the side of a cliff before we flew away. But that's because they were there to begin with and we were in the process of getting picked up by a helicopter. So different circumstance, but in general, most of the time, like doing cool guy ALS stuff, it's just not practical in a wilderness environment. You want to get all that done and then you want to move your patient. That's the reality of how life works in this space. But I've ranted about that a lot. All right. I feel like I owe all of our listeners that have listened to this long diatribe a summary of my thoughts. So here they come. Prepare yourselves. Wilderness technical rescue is not a skill set in and of itself. It's a combination of understanding the principles of mechanical advantage and then imparting them into the wilderness environment you're operating in, right? This can be alpine environments. This can be tropical environments. This can be high deserts. This can be more Appalachian. Every one of those things or performing wilderness rescue in those environments, whether it's canyoneering or whether it's cliff faces in the mid-Atlantic, they're all based on the same principles of understanding force and angles. So those are the things that you should go pursue first. You can also get knowledge in commercial and industrial access and fire department rescue and all of those things. But they're all based in the same principles. Don't chase the stuff. Chase the principles first. Wilderness rescue is actually an amalgamation of lighter weight equipment from like the caving world and the climbing world and some new things that are coming to market, but you don't need to have steel everything with 47 point harnesses to go 3, 4, 5, 6 miles into the woods to go rescue someone. It's not how it works. If you're doing rescue in a caving park, you're going to have rescue in a caving type park or a caving environment, you're going to have more caving specific equipment. If you're on a big wall like Yosemite, you're going to have more caving specific equipment. I said caving, climbing specific equipment. If you're coming on a heavy rescue truck, you're going to have a lot of steel carabiners and things. All of those skills are based on the same principles, but they are very different in execution and learning. Here's an example. You might maybe in 2023, but probably not 2024, probably not be driving a bunch of pitons on a big wall, but you're certainly not going to be using piton type or bolts in an alpine environment, right? You need to know how to do plaquettes and parallel plaquettes and alpine specific skill set, right? These are all things that are just related to staying safe in the environment and building a system that is, that meets your safety factor for your rescue operations, 10 to 1, 15 to 1, whatever that number is. There is no such thing as doing quote unquote wilderness rescue. There is the rescue skill set for the environment in which you're operating. There, did I say that right?
Yeah, basically. Again, it's the principles based, right? Like my argument, there's no such thing as wilderness medicine. There's only medicine executed in the wilderness. It's rope access and rope rescue executed in the wilderness. And some of the techniques will change. Some of the equipment will change, but the foundational principles are all the same.
And three, my third point in my summary, because Sean said that way better than I did. My third point in summary, seek out schools and instructors that understand the principles of force and force management, not clickety widgets, to quote my buddy Eddie. You can go buy all the clickety widgets in the world, but if it turns out you drop your clickety widget and you don't understand the principles of what you're trying to achieve, you're screwed. So clickety widgets come second after we understand the principles. All right. I think that about sums up everything I wanted to mention. Sean, is there anything else you wanted to bring up?
No, I think we shot all over the place with this one.
Yeah, we did.
And I think if folks are interested, we can discuss some of the more specific pieces as it applies to wilderness rope rescue stuff in later episodes. But I think this kind of gives an initial things to think about when you're looking at this training or maybe already involved in this space. I don't know, folks. Look at your kit. I'm not telling you to go throw away everything you own, especially if you're like most of us and you buy all your own stuff because you have specific personal favorites of certain types of carabiners you like or harnesses or whatever. We're not advocating any one thing over another. I think you've heard us say that enough, but think about the things you carry and why you're carrying them. This is also something that Mike and I notice a lot at the course we teach together, and probably not so much at the other ones he goes, because those guys don't carry hardly anything, but man, you'll see people in the rescue world with a harness and gear loops are filled to the max with stuff. And they can't tell you exactly why all that's on their harness. If you can't tell me exactly why a specific thing is on your harness, why is it there? Like you might want that. Like a lot of people like extra pieces of webbing, extra carabiners, various things, right? Some of that's really handy to have, but doesn't need to be on your harness. Or could that be something that's in your pack, right? Like just other little things that you need to start thinking about in this world is to not just buy the thing because it looked cool. And I saw a dude that had one once, so I thought I should have one too. Know what you've got and why you're carrying it. And if you really have no idea what it is for, why you have it, if it's part of a team issue kind of thing, ask about that. And if nobody has any idea, maybe you should just not be having it or quit carrying it. Like those principles that Mike talked about, right? Well, friction coefficients are very important and pulleys are amazing. You can get all the same stuff done without pulleys. I'm not advocating anybody get rid of pulleys for the love of God, but that doesn't mean everybody needs to be carrying four pulleys on their harness. I don't care how small they are.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Principles, people. Principles.
It is principles. And there's a lot of good schools out there, but I am seeing more and more schools pop up that are teaching all the clickety widgets as opposed to the principles. And it worries me a little bit, to be honest, because if you don't understand the principles of what you're trying to achieve, all the clickety widgets, as Eddie likes to call them, aren't going to do you a damn bit of good if it turns out that you don't have the right widget for the right problem.
Yeah.
And rescue is all about solving problems when we have less than optimal situations, especially in the woods.
Yeah, for sure. Especially, because, well, and I know some places are different, but for Mike and I, it's that equipment comes on backs, right? Like, even, and we'll do this case study that involved this incident. Yeah, we were actually on rope having to do some work. And even still, when you drove up to the trailhead, it was still a couple of miles up because everything goes up in the mountains, right? Like it was a couple miles up. And that was one of the very shorter technical rescue things because a lot of stuff, especially for Mike and I where we're at, none of those are right off, unless you go right off the road into one of the steep embankments. And showing up in the truck and like, okay, jocking up and doing everything from right there, it doesn't occur. you've got to get into the woods miles first. You got to start thinking about a lot of those different things.
It's more stuff isn't always better in the wilderness environment, but we should probably talk about that more in a separate podcast about.
That's what I'm saying is perhaps we should do an episode on like gear selection. Yeah.
Yeah. When we're together in a couple of weeks, maybe we should post some pictures of what we carry.
Sexy.
Yeah. That's how I roll. All right. I'm going to stop the recording now and
okay.
Wish you would do. So talk to you later. See you. Bye.
If you have any questions or comments or ideas for show topics, you can send us an email at theshow@emsonthemountain.com or hit us up on social media. We can be found on Facebook and Instagram at EMS on the Mountain, Twitter at EMSOTM, or you can engage with us and a whole community of wilderness EMS professionals at locals.com/wilderness EMS.
Until the next episode, thanks for joining us. And until we see you on the mountain, train hard. Be safe and do good work.